Welcome to the Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
Nate, you got to hang with one of the greatest musicians of our time.
How lucky am I?
And surrounded by string instruments.
Yeah.
Bela Fleck.
This was so fun. I mean, just the best way to spend an afternoon. Bela was in town over the holidays with the Flecktones performing, you know, his
Christmas stuff.
Yeah. You know, it was sort of a hybrid show. Mm. It was like Christmas music from Jingle All the Way and material from the Flecktones' long career. You know, it was kind of a band reunion. So it brought out all the Flecktonians. But before the show, we were able to get Bela to join us at Vintage Instruments, which is a music instrument shop.
House?
It's in a historic house on Broad Street, within hailing distance of the Kimmel Center. And it is like three or four stories of just many vintage instruments, as the name implies, and then some new ones. But, you know, like banjos, mandolins, violins.
It's a plectrous dream.
It truly is. And we sat down surrounded by banjos for a conversation.
Who says that, first of all?
Yeah.
We sat down surrounded by banjos.
Banjo heaven. And so it was just such a fun energy, because something about the historic feeling of the house, and then just the like the friendly vibes of, you know, like the proprietor who was really kind to us and welcoming. After the interview, you know, the hang went on for a while because Bela went upstairs and was just kind of looking at old instruments, you know, including some like historic banjos that were, who knew, but Philadelphia was actually like a major industrial center for the invention of banjos. Yeah. Back in the day, which I guess makes sense when you think about it, right?
Martin guitars too.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just like geeking out, right?
Yeah.
But the conversation itself touched on a whole number of things. We, you know, I was bursting with questions for Bela, you know, because his career is so interesting. I wonder if you have like a story about when you first began hearing him.
Well, I first heard him with the Flecktones.
Okay.
At Tipitina's.
Oh, wow. So would this have been like in the early 90s or like mid-90s?
Mid-90s.
Yeah, wow.
Mid-90s, yeah. And I just remember them being the really cool shit.
Yeah.
You know, especially at that time in my life, you know, like I was just like, it was fun. Still is fun.
Yeah.
And hearing somebody play the bass like Victor Wooten, you know, was sort of mind-blowing.
Yeah. It is. I think fun is the word. It's a super fun band.
Yeah.
It's a band that harnesses like mind-bending virtuosity in a way that doesn't feel self-congratulatory, but feels generous, you know? It's kind of like, hey, like, how about this, you know? And that's always been the spirit. I think that comes, you know, the Wooten brothers have that, but I think it really emanates from Bela. He just feels like that kind of music maker. His music is for the people.
Yeah, and also I feel like he has something very similar to what Chick had, which is just a real wide open, playful approach to the music, you know, and a willingness to just like, oh, you want to take it there? Let's go.
Yeah.
And obviously he has the capability, proficiency, technical and otherwise, to go anywhere, but not everyone just says, yeah, let's go wide open.
You know, the other part of that is curiosity.
Yeah.
A curiosity that is diametrically opposed to any form of complacency. Because Bela, it would be very easy for him to just reach cruising altitude and just be like, well, you know, I'm basically the greatest banjo player, technically speaking, in the world. I mean, even he would even argue with that, but I think most of the rest of us would probably say that. He could just be like, well, you know, I'm just gonna like enjoy this and do my thing. But he's always sort of turning over rocks and saying like, well, like, what about this? And what about this? And I haven't followed this lead before.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he could just as easily say, yes, I'm the inheritor of Earl Scruggs and Tony Trischka and, you know, I'm next. And he could sort of live in that space mm-hmm. rather comfortably. I think you're right, you know, but yeah, he's too curious.
And it's exciting to me that we are sharing this at WRTI because, you know, our genre purview, if you will, is jazz and classical music. And Bela is wonderfully neither and both, but he really and truly speaks to the entirety of our, you know, our audience scope. Someone who has played Bach and Gershwin, written his own symphonic work, performed in chamber settings, and thrown down with the likes of Antonio Sanchez and Chick Corea and, you know, on and on and on. It's all music.
Yeah, but there's only a handful of people that I think can kind of get it on that level. Mm-hmm. You know, Bobby McFerrin's another.
Yeah.
So here's Nate's conversation with Bela Fleck from Vintage Instruments in Philadelphia. By the way, before we get into it, you can see this conversation on WRTI's YouTube channel. So be sure to check that out, and also be sure to keep listening right now.
Bela Fleck, welcome to Philadelphia.
Good to be here.
It's such a pleasure to be with you in this space surrounded by banjos.
Yeah, it's all I can do to not grab every banjo and check it out right now. But
right. Something tells me that they wouldn't mind. You know, I was just thinking about the last time I saw you with the Beat Trio, which features Edmar Castaneda and Antonio Sanchez.
Antonio.
What an incredible band. The notes were flying. But the sensitivity and the collaboration was just so flowing and open. But one thing in particular that I wanted to ask you about was this bond with Edmar.
Mm.
And it made me think of your collaboration with Tumani Diabate. And then just, you know, fingers on strings. There's a sort of kinship that I think, a special kinship that I think you have when you're collaborating with another person who's got fingers on strings, you know? Could you speak to that a bit?
Well, I love it. I mean, the thing about playing with Edmar and Antonio is just like we're all percussionists. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to worry about rhythm. It kind of takes care of itself. And then the other beautiful thing is they're both incredible accompanists. So if it was just me, there's been times when I played just with Edmar as a duo and it was really fun. He just has a beautiful rhythmic pocket. And I have to say, same thing with Tumani. It was like playing with Tumani because he would almost rather support than solo. It was mm-hmm. like you had to prod him to solo, then he'd kick ass. But Edmar loves to solo, but he's a great accompanist. And then the bond with Antonio, it's like sometimes you find people that you agree with on 16th notes and where they sit.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden life gets very easy. I've had that experience also with Zakir Hussain. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a very easy time, like remarkably easy time playing together. That was like, and then playing with Tony Rice and Sam Bush, like when those two guys were together and I got to play with that, with them, there was a magical, I call it the magical carpet ride.
Yeah.
When it's going right, because we also talk about this in the bluegrass world, a floating sensation where nobody's making it happen. It's just happening by itself, but it only happens if everyone has that rhythmic ability and sensitivity. And as a banjo player, I'm essentially, I feel like I'm a percussionist and it drives me, rhythm drives me. It's the one thing banjo really does well. There's a mm-hmm. lot of things it doesn't do well, but that's a home base for me.
Well, so that's interesting, thinking about rhythm as a key element in that, because the thing that I kept puzzling over, and this was true when I saw Beat Trio. It's been true when I saw you with Chick Corea. Just this kind of puzzle in my head, like, man, they're so busy in terms of what's happening. Why doesn't it feel busy? Why doesn't it feel cluttered?
Right.
It actually feels very like open, you know, which is kind of a magic trick.
That's a function of really great time. Mm-hmm. You know, when music has, when everyone in the band has a really great time, then the spaces in the notes create a space. But if people are sloppy, and I mean, there's some of the greatest music in the world is sloppy. And I say sloppy, I mean, not metrically perfect.
You know? Right.
There is a magical rhythmic fabric that happens when people all feel that and feel, I agree where the note starts.
Right.
You know,
right.
And especially in a kind of a grid kind of music, it's harder to get that in a more open, expansive, like certain kinds of jazz that are loose and there's a lot of back of the beat playing pushed against, you know, the bass is in time, technically, the drums are painting, the saxophone is way behind, you know, and that makes a beautiful, beautiful sound, but it's a different thing. It's not necessarily what the banjo is going to do the best. So I have gravitated towards things where I can do things that I can do well, even though on a personal musical level, I wish I could do some of these other things. I wish I had the piano skills to have the harmony understanding that a lot of great jazz players have. What I do have is a rhythmic point of view. And so I think Chick Corea was comfortable with that. Like I said, hey, Chick, man, I'm really not a jazz musician. You know that, right? And he said, don't worry. You play whatever you want and I'll make it work. I was like, oh, that's going to be nice.
It's a good invitation.
Yeah. It was an invitation to be yourself and give him a different opportunity to figure out how to, you know, justify what I play, which is part of what you do as an accompanist. And someone else plays something, you're not judging it. You're like, whatever you do is okay because we're improvising. Mm-hmm. And then you figure out how can I, someone plays a wrong note, you echo it, or you play a different wrong note, yeah. And then all of a sudden it all makes sense. Or if somebody has a rhythmic fluff, you do a funny little rhythmic push and it all connects. It's a conversation. Mm-hmm. So again, on the rhythmic side, I feel pretty confident in certain kinds of rhythm.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the bluegrass conversation, and you know you came up in a certain tradition, and right. I'm struck by the fact that you know so WRTI, as you know, is a jazz and classical music station.
Right.
So a banjo player would seem to be an odd fit for either of those formats, and yet both our classical and our jazz broadcasts have played your music.
Right.
Well, which I think speaks to your breadth and flexibility and all of the exploration that you've done around genre.
But they're only odd if you don't know your history.
Right.
If you know your history, there's nothing odd about it because when jazz started, it had a banjo in it. When Louis Armstrong started jazz, if you want to, you know, simplify it to that point, that when Louis Armstrong started jazz, the instrument that was around was the banjo, and guitar hadn't come in at all, you know. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were banjo orchestras. Large groups of people playing classical music of the day, playing Bach, playing modern songs, playing, mm-hmm. you know, the current songbook of the day, but also some very, very technical wizards on the banjo. And it was, if you think about how the guitar became in the 60s, 70s, 80s and on, maybe still is, that was the instrument that had that spot. But so to me, what I discovered, since I'm from New York City, I'm not a Southern guy who grew up in the bluegrass heartland. It was always a little weird for me that I played bluegrass. You know, until I started to learn more of the history and realized there were lots of New Yorkers. There was a lot of banjo playing going on in New York in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And yeah, certainly through the heyday of, you know, 20s and 30s and 40s, it was a big part of things. So it made more sense that I was into it. And as I discovered that there's banjos in every culture, not every, but a lot of cultures around the world, it's just a connective tissue between a lot of musics. And it's also kind of like a cockroach of instruments because you can't stamp it out.
Yeah.
It keeps coming back some different way. So when jazz, because of minstrelsy, you know, minstrelsy is of white people dressing, painting themselves black and singing songs about how lovely it is on the old plantation. When that became extremely tiresome to black people who knew what that really was like, and the guitar showed up, it was like a night and day transition get rid of that banjo, put the guitar in there. We don't want to, you know, be connected to those old days. And unfortunately, in that process, lost something that was very culturally very special to that world. But then guitar took over. And in fact, they probably have some of these in the shop, but Gibson had to make an instrument for banjo players who were out of work. And if you've ever seen a four-string tenor guitar, that was because within a year, banjo playing was expunged from jazz music, right? And modern music of that time. And people were going to get, but nobody knew how to play it yet. Right. Banjo players, they could play a four-string banjo, but they didn't know how to play a six-string guitar. So they made these instruments, and it's kind of an interesting
thing. You did recently a centennial tribute to Rhapsody in Blue, which is a marvelous tribute and a beautiful sort of act of translation as well, instrumentally.
It's a big job.
Thinking about even just that opening clarinet glissando as translated. There's another landmark that is celebrating 100 years, which is the Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Sevens, which did have a banjo.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you...
Did we pass that already?
So the very first sessions were in 1925, and then there were others in 1926. So we're basically right in the midst of the centennial season.
Oh, I wish I had known that a little earlier.
Do you have any relationship to those
I've listened records? To those things. I always love hearing that period, but I love everything Louis did. Mm-hmm. You know, I just... think he was just he's an outlier. All these people we've been talking about are outlier, strange, unique people, and I'm attracted to those people. And the Flecktones are a great example of that. Everyone in the band when we started was a weird wacko that, you know, nobody did what they did but them.
Yeah.
And so as time went on, we started attracting other weird wackos, you know, and they were we always had our radar out for people that were not normal. And, you know, I mean that in the best of ways. People have really gone their own path, and people like Edmar turned up on our radar, or Paul Hansen, who played the bassoon, you know, jazz bassoon, or just, you know, those kinds of folk. Andy Norell, the way he plays the steel pans.
Mentioned history, and I wanted to ask about this experience you had delving into the African roots of the banjo. You went to Africa, you met a lot of musicians, and studied not only the history, but also just the way that the culture pulses there.
Right. That was a big piece of it, yeah.
So I wanted to ask, you know, you have this lifelong relationship with your instrument. Was it altered in some way by that experience?
It was broadened, for sure. For instance, in Mali, people like Baseko Kouyaté, who's, you know, teaching all his kids to play. And now, ever since that movie, now I've been meeting them as adults. It's been that long, you know, and seeing how his whole family and his forefathers all played the Ngoni. And he's continuing and he's passing it on. And that familial part of it. And it's tricky. Like when I'm listening to that music, it will come out in my playing when I'm focusing on it. But in other words, I kind of think that musicians like me, there's a spontaneity that goes on. So whatever's bubbling around sort of reemerges in your playing if you're not thinking about it too much. The African stuff is always in there as an option, just like the Indian stuff or the Irish stuff or, you know, whatever, Latin stuff, things that I've spent some time with. And they're sort of in this big pot. I think of it as a gumbo, not a puree, because there could be bigger chunks here and there. They might pop out. So that whole African experience, there was the cultural side of it and just the warmth of being with all those people. It was an incredibly beautiful time. And then there was the music that I actually learned. But a lot of times I didn't know the music and I was improvising. So how could I carry that on? I could take it on, like if you were a jazz musician and you learned a new interesting harmonic phrase, you might play with it and come up with ideas from it. And so in that way, a lot of the different things that I did over there are in my playing and in my soup, and they come out when they want to. You know, it's a little vague, but that's honestly how it is. Because I'm not trying, I don't say I'm going to write an African tune or I'm going to write, you know, an Indian tune. I just try and write music and then later figure it out how it's going to go. So, but all the things that I did in Africa helped me when I started playing with Zakir Hussain a lot, mm-hmm. even though they're completely different cultures and worlds. It just set me up to be open and to listen in a different way and respond. But all these things change you and make you a better musician and person, hopefully. I had quite a good idea of what I was getting into in Africa. In most cases, I had studied up what kind of music is happening in this region, what did I really like, because my job was also to curate, not just mm-hmm. to play with anything that popped up, but right. actually to find stuff that I thought was amazing and highlight that and interact with that, because I was curious myself. But no, even knowing that, I'll say it's like you can know a pizza's going to taste good, but you still have to eat it to experience it.
Right.
So I could have just listened to the records and never gone there, and a lot of the information I could have gotten, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the visceral, is that the word, experience of being there mm-hmm. and in their homes and, you know, all that.
Yeah. You know, we when we're talking about that journey, there's a temporal dimension too, in that you're there working with contemporary African musicians mm. who are accessing this ancient lineage of
right.
music. But it's a present tense, you know, you're playing in real time and connecting in real time. But then there's also this this history of the instrument, you know, and,
right.
and which is tied up with so much in American culture and history, some of which people try to brush under the rug. And so did the real-time present tense experience also inform the way you understand that history?
Yeah, I mean, they were just like me. Like Baseka was just like me. Tumani's just like me. They're just trying to play good. They're trying mm-hmm. to take in outside influences and bring them out in their own way with a connection to the past and a love of the history and a responsibility to respect their instrument and have people understand that it's really special. Like they're all on a crusade, just like I am, like, hey, the banjo's cool. Like, and not only that, it's not what you think it is. It's not just a Southern white instrument, while pointing out that some of the greatest American music ever created is bluegrass, you know, and old time music that is Southern, a lot of it Southern white. But as Rhiannon or someone like that might mention, well, you know, we didn't get to hear a lot of the black people that were playing that music because they weren't recorded. So it's all very complex. It's kind of a weave.
Mm. Yeah. I want to ask also about your name, as it pertains to this whole conversation, because Béla Bartók was, of course, a great composer, but he was also a very impassioned ethnomusicologist.
Right.
And someone who was very concerned about folk music and the dignity of folk music. And so I wondered when you began to understand that legacy and what it has meant in your life, was there a point at which it really sort of, like a light bulb went off for you?
My parents had this arrangement. If we were boys, the father would get to name us. If we were girls, the mother would get to name us. My father was a classical music fan, and he named me Béla Anton Lajos Fleck after Béla Bartók, Anton Webern, and Lajos Janáček. My brother Louis, Ludwig, he got a different set of names. Now, the funny part about it, have you ever heard the song A Boy Named Sue by Johnny Cash?
Of course.
So they split up when I'm 1 or 2 years old, and he disappears, like, essentially never to be seen again. So I figured I got the name so I would learn to fight Béla, you know, which was, but it didn't work out that way. But anyway, years later, I went and found him, and we developed some kind of relationship before he passed, and that was a good thing. But yeah, what is the power of a name, right? That's an interesting thing, because Béla couldn't have been a more apt name for who I ended up being, but it wasn't because I said, oh, that's my name, so I should go do this or do that.
Right.
He wasn't around showing me why he liked, you know, esoteric classical. I mean, this is some edgy classical music, mm-hmm. but I have stepfather, Joe Palladino, and he was more of a centrist. He liked Brahms and Haydn and, you know, more consonant stuff. So I heard a lot of that when I was in my teens, and I got that influence. But as time went on and I got into like more modern jazz, more 12 tone music, all that kind of stuff, all of a sudden Bartok became very interesting to mm-hmm. me. And I love it now, but it was also abrasive in the beginning. I was like, I don't know, you know, I don't know about this Bartok stuff, but
right.
you had to almost get to a certain age for me. And also being surrounded by so much bluegrass and stuff that's not so harmonically complex.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to think that you could have been an Anton as a first name.
Yeah.
Like it could have easily been yeah. flipped, right?
Yeah. Right. And then what have I been? Yeah. But I really love his music now. I find it to be one of the really special, unique things. And just because he's one of those people like we're talking about, he's just so unique.
I guess it was maybe your use of the word consonant just now that made me think of it, but in some of your compositions that have crossed over into a classical area, one of these is the Juno Suite for your son, which is just a beautiful piece of music has a lot of, you know, there are kinships with, you know, Aaron Copland. You know, it's a very American sounding symphonic piece. Can we talk about that?
Yeah,
piece
sure.
of music?
Yeah, I had no idea how much it sounded like a piece for the common man. Until I wrote it on the piano, just finding those chords, and I was like, oh, well, that sounds like good music. Let's do that. And it wasn't until the first performances I was like, oh my God, this sounds a lot like that Copland piece, because I've tried to avoid Copland and at all costs because I tend to get pushed towards it. Like if ever I have my concerto, the first thing they say is, let's put on, you know, a Copland piece with it. And I'm like, oh, can't we be a little more creative?
Yeah.
I liked it once I played in Chattanooga and they did Bela and Bela. And it was Bartok and Fleck. And I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
You know, but Copland, I don't know. Sometimes it's kind of like a Americana, but a little cheesy for me. Since he's not here anymore, I can say that without insulting anybody. But it's just not my favorite. How about some Barber? You know, if we're going to do some Gershwin even is such a unique character. I know that, there, you know, when you go back to the German music, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms even, it's another level of composition, to be fair, but also they weren't in the cultural moment that Gershwin was in, and he managed to do some pretty incredible things.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you are composing at the piano. And is that
very rarely?
So that's specifically for orchestral sort of symphonic type.
Just in a rare moment when I'm like stuck because the banjo was just so stuck in its range. I've just got only from here to here. And so sometimes I'll go to the piano. I've had a few lucky things, like the Flight of the Cosmic Hippo was written like on the piano with two fingers. I don't play the piano. Don't get me wrong. But I think occasionally I'll go sit. We have a piano in our living room, and sometimes anyone in my house will sit and start composing, mm-hmm. whether it's me or Abby or the boys, and just because it sounds great in that room. It's just a beat up old upright, and it's led to a lot of different people, you know, coming up with a good little hook or a good harmonic idea or a melody. So I like that, but it's not something I do a lot or that I'm good at.
Is there any Bartok in your solo banjo repertoire?
No, there isn't. I had some pieces that Abby and I did as a duo, mm-hmm. but I don't have any. But although when I was trying to figure out what to record with the Gershwin, I considered and started working on the Bartok viola concerto, which I thought, you know, everyone laughs at the viola, everyone laughs at the banjo, so let's... marry the two. Yeah, I did have an arrangement of the last movement ready, and it just turned out not to be the right thing for that project. But I'm mm-hmm. hoping that could happen sometime. That'd be really fun.
You mentioned Rhiannon Giddens.
Yeah,
Rhiannon is doing this work. Chris Thiele is doing this work. There's a number of people who are, you know, in my mind, they're carrying on something that you helped instigate in terms of really taking roots music and showing how generative it is, how alive it is, and how it connects with kind of everything, you know,
how
flexible it can be.
It can, yeah. But I also like it when people commit to the old music and make that, because then you get to hear that again, you know, and it doesn't have to
Rhiannon
be
And Rhiannon does that too. Yeah. And, you know, so there's this kind of multimodality, if you will.
Right.
And so I want to talk about that legacy that I think, you know, it's fair to say, is a part of your career, you know, to really sort of show what's possible in this space and with this tradition. Do you look at what's happening and feel a sense of satisfaction about it?
Yeah, I think I could take credit as long as my teachers can take credit as well. Mm-hmm. You know, like my teacher, Tony Trischka, he took the ball from all the way over here and he brought it all the way over here and maybe much more profound change from beginning to end, not that he's done, than me, because I was able to build a lot of what I did on things that he opened the doors. Like, oh, you can do, like, you know, play banjo without saxophone music while the drums are going crazy. Oh, I didn't know you were allowed to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Just a lot of the musical things he came up with to do on the banjo that nobody had thought of before were very personal to his playing, very much... So, and also a lot of that encouragement to be yourself and not feel stuck by what's been done before. So there's that. So before him, there was Bill Keith, who trailblazed with the banjo. Before him, there was a lot of people. So even Earl Scruggs himself, who we said the traditionalist, well, I mean, is a tradition, can it be a tradition when it's not even 100 years old yet anyway? Well, if it is, he came out of nothing. Nobody had done what he did before. And now we just think it's normal. But it's not normal. He's the one guy that figured this out. It's a continuum, and now there are people coming behind me that are amazing. And I have a banjo camp, and I'm getting to see some of these people that, like, I never had the John McLaughlin speed, the Yngwie speed. That's just not something that was my hands did naturally. But I've got some kids that do, and that are going to Berkeley and learning from great jazz teachers, which I couldn't do when I was in Boston. I wanted to go to Berkeley. When I got out of high school, I was in a bluegrass band. It wasn't possible to be a banjo major there. I wanted that information so bad. I took lessons from some of the teachers from there, and they kind of got me on a path, but it wasn't available like it is now. So that's a big deal. But I can't take, it's a whole movement. It's like a whole pile of people that are all pushing them all forward, and it's very natural. And then there are people who hate it, you know, really disappointed. They're like, that's not what I love about bluegrass. And in fact, it's kind of crazy being from New York. When I'd play in New York, everyone would say, play more traditional. That's not why we came to see you.
Right.
But then when I'd go down south and play where there's a lot of bluegrass, they'd say, hey, that's cool. The reverse of what you'd think, that New York would be more progressive and the south would be more repressive. No, they were like, we've heard a lot of bluegrass. It's nice to hear somebody doing it different, you know? Hard to point to too many examples of something that kind of personal and unique that can play, you know, significant sized theaters and draw a crowd around the country. That's kind of wild. And I think that's partly due to a certain common man approach to music that I think the banjo kind of encourages in me. As much as I want to be Scriabin or, you know, whoever, you know, the banjo makes me want to do music that has a common theme and has that a common man can listen to and feel something, you know? So as esoteric as we might get, I always wanted to have a base in something very human and natural. So I think that's maybe what works, because the Flecktones can do some pretty out there music, but it doesn't feel that out there when you're watching it, because not only is that their common man aspect, but also the Wootens and Howard Levy and Jeff have a lot of performance ethic. So there's a lot of jazz musicians who would not even, you know, look at the audience, that have a very introverted aspect. And it's hard to win over an audience when you're like that, even though it's perfectly reasonable as a musician to be that way, as a person to be that way. But the Wootens were at Busch Gardens. That was one of their first gigs. They're working at a theme park playing. One year they'd be in the Oompah band, another band time they'd be in the country band, then they'd be in the funk band, you know, and they would do 5-8 shows a day doing the exact same show. And they were very comfortable with performative music while being incredibly adept jazz-oriented, funk-oriented musicians that improvise like crazy. So when the Flecktones started, we had no problem with the idea that we were going to put on a show and get people interested and use the stage in a way that was not static. And that just really helped. It just really helped.
And sort of make novelty your friend in the sense of...
Own it.
Like, this is this weird... Like, what is this? And then within, you know, about 4 bars, you're like, oh, there's a lot of music happening here.
Right. But the trick was to not repel people with the complexity and also mm-hmm. have something like if you get their attention, that might work for a little while. Novelty, you know, people say, oh, novelty act, you know, then they're done and then they're gone. But the idea was to have enough real music embedded underneath the novelty that the novelty got you to give it a few watches or listens. And then you might go, you know, I kind of like the music itself. I'd like to have that in my life, which is this: when music succeeds is when people want to have the music in their life, whether it's to go to sleep by, to go running by, to sit and listen to. If that doesn't happen, then they hear it, it passes by, and they move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
There's got to be something sticky that makes you want to hear it again. And that's what a pop hook has, mm-hmm. you know?
So when we talk about music that has a kind of ambition or complexity, but also a common touch,
yeah.
If I were to ask you to pick up the banjo and play anything from your wheelhouse that speaks to that balance, what would you play?
I don't know.
Can we find out?
Well, I could play something. Let's see. Any banjos around here? Oh, there's one. There's a banjo. I mean, I think something like maybe. So then it has a bridge. Let me see. Bridge has a lot in it, like I mean, not a crazy amount, but there's definitely some different harmony in there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you present it surrounded by a very funky, you know, natural sort of groove, you can kind of put it in there. No, it doesn't repel anybody.
Yeah.
And then you can solo over it and have fun exploring those changes, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Things like that. So there's one that I'd say probably the ones that the Flecktones have done the best with have had some, you know, they're kind of friendly tunes.
Mm-hmm.
But then we can do stuff with them.
Right.
You know?
I mentioned the Juno Concerto.
Yeah.
Is there a theme from that you could play also?
Yeah, maybe. Sure. There's a... Remember what happens after that, but the fun thing with that, I was playing with groups of five, 1 2 3 4 5, 1 2 3, and in this position it just falls off the hand. There's something I think maybe I'd have to think about the other parts, but a lot of it is so interlocked into the orchestra writing.
Yeah.
So when you have something like that that's very pattern based and going up like that, then you'd have to make sure the orchestra part is not.
Mm-hmm.
So it provides a contrast.
In the orchestration of that piece, there's some really nice, I don't know if in the classical terminology they use the words call and response, but yeah. There is some of that between you and individual members of the orchestra and then the orchestra itself.
Right. It's fun when you've got 100 people on stage, or give or take, and there are sections where the whole orchestra or whole sections are involved, and then you can drop it down to three people. And I like doing that a lot,
mm-hmm.
and because it just suddenly becomes chamber music, and you can, you know, just lock with those people and build a little sound, and then the orchestra can come back and fill. Because the dynamics is another real gift of that situation. You can be much more dynamic in an orchestra setting, and it works.
Right.
If something gets soft and someone's listening on their iPad or whatever, they just turn it off. That just went away instead of going, oh, it's so beautiful, you know.
How old was Juno when you composed that piece?
Good question. I think it probably two, something like two. Yeah. And
so he's grown up hearing it. He's
he's not all that interested in Papa's music. He's playing the fiddle now, and okay. He likes traditional. So he's always like, Papa, you should play more traditional music. He's like on a traditional spree, and he likes Celtic music. He loves, but he's a lucky kid, and he'll find that out one day. That, you know, I have video of him being given a piano lesson in Chick Corea's lap. I have him sitting at the tablas with Sakir, showing him how to hit the tablas. Stuart Duncan and Michael Cleveland come over with their fiddles. They're in the house, and he's a fiddle player. Yeah. He's the best bluegrass guys, are, you know, historically some of the greatest ever. And every once in a while, he wasn't into the Flecktones. And then this tour that we're on now, it's like I came home and he was practicing Stomping Grounds on the fiddle, which one of our tunes. So it's like, okay, just don't push, just let it happen. You know, but he's proud of me. He knows that I'm, you know, good at what I do, and I'm fortunate enough that people like what I do and think I'm good and stuff. But his tastes haven't evolved all the way yet. But he's 12.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Abigail perform as a duo, which was really, really special.
Yeah, that's really fun. Very cool thing.
Is there an effect that having a kid and sort of watching, you know, the development and, you know, the different sort of phases, like, has that changed your musicianship in some way?
Yeah, because when you're playing a lot and getting a lot of attention, you can have the mistaken idea that it's the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is have a human being that you're responsible for to realize it's not. So that takes some pressure off it, which, you know, just being like this all the time about music is not the healthiest thing. And it's worked well for me. I always tell people it's not the best way to be, but it does work when you're trying to progress on an instrument and you just need to put in a lot of time and be motivated. And mm-hmm. I can go in that. I can get psycho practicing till I hurt myself. That's still in me. But now I have something, you know, it's a more important, you know, sometimes. So I'm taking more time off. I'm home more. And the pressure off the music is a good thing. I think it makes it more relaxed and more natural and less pushed. What am I going to do next? You know, what haven't I done? It's all so important. It's not important.
Right.
It's just this moment, you know.
Do you have a really active practice regimen, or is it something where it's more like just kind of maintaining, because you've already put in all the hard work to get to a certain...
It's funny. I remember Stanley Clarke once said in one of these interviews, I was with him, and he said, I practiced a lot when I was young, so I don't have to practice anymore.
Right.
And I was like, doesn't work that way for me, but, you know, more power to you. He's incredible. And part of his looseness is from not over-practicing. There's mm-hmm. a looseness and a spontaneity that you can lose by playing all the time.
Yeah.
You know? So Marcus Roberts was kind of the same. He said to me one day, you're a practicer, aren't you? And I said, yeah, how do you know? He said, because you're in the next room to me. he said, I want you to try something tonight. We were doing like six nights in a jazz club together. He said, try not playing at all tomorrow and see what your playing is like when you get to the bandstand. So I was like, oh, this is going to be a hard day, because I was like, for one thing, I'm intimidated and I want to be good enough to play with him. Mm-hmm. But for another thing, that's my motivation, is to try keep trying to get better at things till I run out of time to playing with that person. So anyway, I took that day off, and that night the improvisation was off the hook. It was like so much more spontaneous. Things that I'd never thought to try were just falling out. So there is a psychology to all of this, mm-hmm. and more is not always better with practicing. It's being smart about your practicing, you know. I was also talking to my friend Edgar Meyer about this, and I had the observation that great improvisers are usually not uptight. They're not tense. Because being loose, if you're around Herbie Hancock and you see them, they're just like, yeah, and chick like, hey, man. You know, it's like everything's all sort of chill. And then they get out there and it just flows out of them. Where if you're like, we're about to go on. Are you ready? Are you in tune? You know, it's not like that. It's like, yeah, what do you think? Should we do that? You know, so, but it's an attitude that feeds the music and allows, because the tighter you are, the less natural things can just come out of you.
Yeah.
And that's a really mysterious thing when things come out of you that you didn't know you knew or that are spurred on by what the other person did. So you never would have made. And that instant leap that your brain makes is like a fight or flight reaction that you're, but if you do it right, it's not a tense fight or flight reaction. It's a very natural reaction to like our conversation or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you learn this stuff as you go along, but.
You've been in the, you know, in the scene for quite a while now, and you've observed various changes in terms of audience, in terms of the industry.
Yeah.
And then at street level, you know, with musicians. And I wonder if you feel that the demarcations around like, well, this is classical music, this is jazz, this is bluegrass, this is, you know, whatever. Has that all kind of loosened or become more permissive over the years?
Yeah, I think people are more comfortable with the idea that there are various kinds of bluegrass. You know, a lot more people like bluegrass than you'd think. In fact, this is interesting to me, but when I was coming up, like classical music was a big deal, jazz was a big deal, bluegrass wasn't such a big deal. And so as time went on and I was trying to like gain entrance to these musics, like I want to play jazz. I want to learn classical just because I wanted to be a better musician. And that's where they were. But also there was like a success to that world. As the years have gone on, a lot of those worlds have reduced while bluegrass has grown. Mm. And it's so kind of bizarre. It's like you get the last seats on the Titanic because classical music was struggling. And, you know, honestly, jazz, I don't think it's, I mean, there's tons of great players, but as it's not the easiest time to be a jazz musician, honestly. But if you're a bluegrass musician, it seems to be a ton of people that are interested, especially if you have your own thing to do with it, like a Billy Strings or a Chris Thiele, Punch Brothers, all of those guys, Sierra Hull, Molly Tuttle, are all having these marvelous careers. And I mean, Billy is playing in arenas.
Yeah.
That has never happened before. And he's playing essentially bluegrass. Maybe he's got a effects pedal on, but he's got a bluegrass band out there. It's not unlike what Newgrass Revival was doing in the 1980s when I was in that band. But it wasn't time for us yet. That band was, today would have been a whole other story.
When you're pressed to actually apply some kind of a label to yourself and your music, is there anything that you reach for?
I don't think I have a good answer to that. I don't know. I love learning. I love learning things. I feel better if there's something new I'm working on. So I'm just pushing my edges out and I'm not, you know, I don't have the skills of someone who reads music or has grown up in a classical or jazz background. So for me, it's a folksy, like a folk musician trying to grab some jazz, I guess I'm a hybrid musician. I have a lot of respect and love for traditions, all of them. And I love the world musics. I love jazz. I love great music of all kinds. I think bluegrass is still a great world music.
Yeah.
It just happens to be from here.
Right.
You know, if you think about flamenco, bluegrass stands up quite well to African music. But the roots are so interesting because they're not from this great geographical place alone. They're a true example of cultures meeting and mingling, bluegrass and jazz, all this American music. That's the great thing about it and what we actually do very well in this country.
You just alluded to feeling happiest when you're working on a thing. So what are you working on?
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, I have a project that I'm just finishing with Renee Fleming, opera singer.
Wow.
So that pushes out of the box a little bit.
Yeah.
But she really wanted to do more of an Americana kind of record, and I put together an A-team of bluegrass people, and we did this very beautiful, evocative record that I'm very proud of. I have a song cycle that's a classical piece with Abigail that we wrote together and built together, and it's about a 40-minute piece that addresses immigration and how sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you wish you hadn't, you know, exploring a lot of themes about how the world is changing right now. I'm really proud of it. And it's been in process for a while, but we're reaching the end of that. And then...
Is that an orchestral piece?
It's an orchestral piece. Okay. Yeah. With Abby and I down front, she's singing a number of songs. And then we have the clawhammer and the three-finger banjo mixed in, and a lot of fun writing. I think some of the writing is... and I think I got better from... when I made my first concerto, I was not a good orchestra writer, and I'm not saying I am now, but I've discovered when we would spend all of our rehearsal time on certain things, instead of getting to play the whole piece at rehearsal, I realized I had to write smarter. And but every time I would go perform with an orchestra, I'd watch and I'd listen and I'd watch the other pieces, and I would ask the musicians, what didn't work? What's hard about this? What can I fix something about it? And so when I wrote Juno, I think I did a lot better. And again, I felt like I wanted to be a person who was a player, composer, arranger. I didn't want someone else's hands all over it. I wanted it to be my,
right?
Because people that I revere so much do that. And that was part of the learning thing. But by the time I've hit this piece, which is now like my fourth piece where I'm writing for orchestra, I think it's just a lot, it just works a lot better for the orchestra now. You just start to learn things about what makes sense.
Right.
So it lays out really nice. And I did get some help. I wasn't afraid to get some help on this one. So that was cool too.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, it's really cool. And then I'll be out. I have more, this is returns, like the Flecktones is a return to something that we did in 2009, the last time, this tour we're doing right now. And we did early year music with Howard back in September. We did a whole tour of that music, and that was all fun to like relearn things we used to do, which is a different process than learning something new. Then I've got things with Beat Trio coming up. We'll be going back into that music, pushing it to the next level. My Bluegrass Heart is coming back around because we have this incredible Ryman show that we filmed and recorded that everybody in the modern bluegrass scene. It's really fantastic. And so that's going to come out and spurn more touring. But in terms of new music, probably the thing that I'm most excited about are some pieces I've been working on for maybe 15 or 20 years called Plain Songs. They present as sort of simple, nice melodies that lay out really well on the banjo and use open strings, but they get quite dense and complicated. So there's like solo partitas or solo pieces for banjo that I've been working towards. And I have quite a few of them written, and I just need to record them and really learn them. I'm excited about doing that and maybe taking solo banjo music into some sacred spaces, places with a beautiful reverb, rooms that are just lovely and lush and will complete the banjo. Like when we did the Zakir Hussain Memorial at Grace Chapel in San Francisco, you play a note and it goes ping, even a banjo note,
yeah.
A lowly short banjo note suddenly has sustain. So I think that can be a beautiful thing. I always love playing in rooms like that. So I want to do some things with that, a solo thing. And there's other things I'm not thinking of right now, but there's a few things.
That's a lot to look forward to.
Duet album with Michael Cleveland, the fiddle player from My Bluegrass Heart, blind musician, unbelievable player. And we've been working, you know, whenever I'm home, we do go record a couple, work up some stuff. And so I think we have 10 so far. I think we'll get to 14 and choose the best 12, and that'll be coming out. So that's something that's pretty much done. It's very different too.
As you're talking about getting the Flecktones back together,
and
you mentioned Stanley, of course, we've talked about Chick. It reminds me of the time I spent embedded with Return to Forever in 2008, just 2007 or 2008, when they were getting back together for the first time in many years.
Yeah.
And it
was the one where we did two of the shows. Flecktones did that. We opened in Boston and here in Philly at the Mann Center.
With
Return to Forever. Right.
I saw them in Austin and then I saw them in New York, I think, again.
Mm-hmm. Where did they play? Was it Beacon?
I think it was the Beacon.
That's where I saw them when I was 17. That changed my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we played there two nights ago, and then I pointed to the audience. That's where I was sitting when Return to Forever played, right in that seat over there, and it had changed my life.
That's amazing. The thing that I was reminded of was when they got back together, there was an interesting tension among them about how to treat the old music. I think Lenny White was really of a mindset of like here's how we did it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like this is the thing that happens here. And, you know, and Chick was, he just couldn't wait to get past all of that so that he could play.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there was this kind of like, well, what are we trying? Are we really trying to access this thing, or are we trying to transcend it? Does it matter? How accurate do we want to be to this vision that we originally had?
Right.
Was there anything like that when you guys were sort of starting the engine up again, or was it not?
Yeah, definitely. So, since we're playing rarely these days, every time we get together, we've got to kind of like reinflate the thing and remember mm-hmm. how everything goes and get, you know, relearn it. And if you're not careful, you can kind of get locked into like ways you played it for a certain period and get sort of stuck back in a certain thing. And that happens for sure. Once you start playing the stuff night after night, nobody can stand to do that. You know, everybody's like Howard, for instance, is such a spontaneous player. He's with that version of the band, he's the catalytic guy. Mm. Like, cause Howard's going to hit you with something he never tried before and he's going to nail it. And so it's like, oh, you better step up your game. And he was always that in the early band when he was in the band. Jeff is different. He's going to supply a lot of rhythmic force and a lot of rootsy power. You know, there's a different thing about him. He's mm-hmm. almost like, I'm trying to think of who the saxophone, but it's a very intense, you know, he's a strong player. And so the band coalesces in a different way with him. And they're both really cool and they're very different. But with the Christmas music, it's very set. You've kind of got to play because there's a lot of counterpoints and things mm-hmm. and very carefully composed arrangements. And so we have to get them right. But then we hit these other songs from the Jeff era and we let them stretch. And I'm still trying to remember the good things that I did 15 years ago when we were doing that music. I'm like, how did I get out of that soul? And finally you go to YouTube and say, oh, I forgot all about that, and that.
Right.
But so you lose some things if you don't study the old thing, but some new things come in too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And then the other thing is, in the old days, with both of those bands, we were playing so much and we had so much repertoire at our fingertips that we could do a different set every night. And if we came back to a town, we could make sure that we played almost completely different music, mm-hmm. Especially within a year or two. When you're getting back together to do a tour and you're only doing 8 days, you make a set list and you play that set list. And I used to feel like a real cad for doing that whenever that would happen, but I've kind of gotten over that because it's just not practical, mm-hmm. you know? And if we're going to do it all year, then that's different.
And it's a beloved holiday right. album.
Well, for that,
people are...
Or back in September when we weren't doing the holiday okay, music, yeah. It was like, what does everybody really want to hear? You know, mm-hmm. We'll do Blue Bop, we'll do Sunset Road, we'll do Sinister Minister, we'll do Stomping Grounds, and we'll surround it with our favorite, you know, deeper cuts. Again, if you're doing it for a few years, you've got a plan to really be in it, then you can start to broaden the set list and start to really have it be more flexible. And that's always a lot of fun, but we're just not really doing that right now. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got other things going on, but it could happen again.
Yeah.
We all love each other.
Mm-hmm. Best of luck with the rest of this tour and with all of this incredible music that's coming. I'm very excited.
Well, thanks.
I don't even know which of these things I'm looking forward to most, but they all sound great.
I feel very fortunate that this is what I get to do with my life and also get to have the family that I have and, mm-hmm. and the support that I have and other things that are more important on a human level, make it more relaxing to work on things, you know, hard things and continue to grow and push because it's not, there isn't such a spotlight on it in my life. It's sharing a spotlight. And so there's benefits to that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bela, thank you so much. What a
Thanks,
pleasure.
Yeah. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too.
That was Nate Chenin with Bela Fleck. Good job, Nate.
Thank you, sir.
from Vintage Instruments in Philadelphia in our area here at WRTI. And don't forget, you can visualize this conversation at our YouTube channel. Check that out. The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Thank you very much. And since you enjoy this podcast, how about leaving us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice? And be sure to subscribe and follow us on all social media.
You can also let us know how we're doing. The email is editor@wrti.org. I am the editor. It goes straight to me, and I will answer your questions or queries and share your feedback with the team.
You just doxed yourself.
I guess I did, but you know, we're all friends here.
Yep.
As you know, The Late Set is hosted by myself, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson. You might not know, but should know, that the show is produced by Alex Arif.
Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. He mixed this episode. Tyler Deerfield was our on-site production assistant. And we also thank our PAs, Alexander Bollocker, Jacob Dodds, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson. Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
Special thanks to the folks from Team Bella, Carla Parisi and Noel Panapinto, and everyone else at Red Light Management.
And a huge thanks to our new friends at Vintage Instruments, Fred Oster, Catherine Jacobs, and Samantha Cody. Again, you can watch a video of this interview taped in front of a wall of mandolins and banjos on our YouTube channel. That's at WRTI Music.
Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philly and also beyond. And we'll see you soon.